a couple of months ago, around Christmas time, I was visiting New York City with my brother and his family, and we were staying at an Airbnb in Brooklyn, about a 30-minute subway ride from Manhattan. And the first night there, I went to a little grocery store nearby to get some eggs for breakfast the next morning, and I was shocked to see that they were almost $8 a dozen. Just for some regular non-organic eggs, probably not free-range or even cage-free. And I hadn't bought eggs for a while, so I just assumed that that was New York prices, even though we weren't in a super wealthy area, where I thought maybe it could be chalked up to being in a food desert, even though there seemed to be plenty of grocery stores around. But no, turns out that that was just my first encounter with eggflation. And then, of course, I started to see it reflected everywhere, not just in the stores when I went to buy eggs, but in jokes about how this Easter we'll be painting potatoes instead of eggs, or how we should rename eggs as chicken caviar, and in bad puns about eggflation and how everything has become so expensive. And, of course, in all the internet memes going around, some of which gave me a good chuckle, like the hen that's all gussied up, rocking a Louis Vuitton purse, a pricey-looking fascinator, strutting around in some Gucci stilettos, living the high life, with the caption, "Chickens now be like." Or the guy on a beach who's kneeling down to propose to his girlfriend, and instead of opening up a box with a diamond ring, it's a carton of eggs, to the delighted reaction of his bride-to-be. Pictures of eggs dropped on the floor with captions about how they'll never financially recover from this, that, oops, there goes the kid's college fund. But jokes aside, the reason behind the rise in prices, which are starting to come down now some, is actually pretty tragic if you hadn't heard it. It's not just inflation in general and the supply chain, although that's part of it. But the biggest reason for it is the deadliest avian flu outbreak in history, which killed more than 50 million birds in the U.S. alone. I mean, that's just a staggering number of birds. At any rate, with eggs on the mind, I thought that egg idioms would make for a good theme for an episode. So welcome to episode 10 of this season's Idiom America. This one's all about eggs. But before diving into some egg idioms, I was first curious about why eggs come in a dozen. Nothing else really comes in a dozen like that, to that degree. Donuts maybe, but even then you can walk into a donut shop and order any number you want. roses too, I guess, but again, you can get whatever number you want there. But eggs, your only options are usually a dozen or half dozen or a dozen and a half or two dozen for the most part. And it turns out that this likely dates back to the units of measurement known as English units, which were used in England up until 1826 when they were replaced by imperial units. And these English units evolved as a combination of the old Anglo-Saxon and Roman systems of units, and they first pop up in the 1215 Magna Carta as a statutory declaration for the uniformity of weights and measures. And in addition to the measures we're still familiar with today, like inch, foot, yard, fathom, mile, league, acre, teaspoon, tablespoon, pint, quart, gallon, ounce, pound, and ton, they included measurements like a barley corn, which was 1/3 of an inch, a poppy seed, which was 1/5 of barley corn, a bovate, which was about 15 acres and equaled the amount of land one ox can plow in 1 year, and a pottle, which was 1/2 gallon or 2 pints. And in that system, there were 12 pennies and a shilling, kind of like we now have 12 inches to a foot. So it makes sense to sell 12 eggs for a shilling. Or that's what some think anyway, although there's no firm evidence there. But breads and rolls were sold the same way at market in a dozen, which gave rise to the idiom baker's dozen, meaning 13 of something. And this term goes back to the 13th century when King Henry III ruled that severe penalties would be inflicted on bakers and others selling goods at market if they cheated their customers. And so to ensure that the buyers were not being accidentally shortchanged, it became common practice for the baker or farmer to put an extra roll or egg into each customer's basket, just to be sure that you wouldn't face that penalty. Hence, baker's dozen is 13, not 12. And something that think that the use of dozen here has more to do with the easy math for the sale and shipment of eggs from farms to urban markets. The number 10 can only be divided by 2 and 5, while 12 can be seen as 2 by 6 or 4 by 3, which makes it better for things like shipping and selling goods. Who knows? In lots of parts of the world, though, eggs aren't sold by the dozen and can be bought by tens or eights or by the egg. But given the fact that we're still using things like miles and feet and gallons here in America, I don't see the dozen eggs going away anytime soon. And just like there's more than one way to skin a cat, there's more than one way to cook an egg. If we're just talking eggs on their own, we got fried eggs, scrambled eggs, boiled, poached, sous vide, and of course the omelet. And egg preparation is such a basic foundation of cooking that we have the idiom, can't boil an egg, to refer to someone who can't even make a simple meal. She can't boil an egg, so he does all the cooking. And there used to be literal truth behind the idiom that you can't unboil an egg, just like you can't unscramble an egg or unring a bell. But scientists in 2015 apparently figured out how to reverse the process and actually unboil a hen's egg with a device that pulls apart the tangled proteins of a cooked egg and allows them to refold. So there's that, I guess. Yay, science. The omelet gives us the idiom proverb, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Also heard is you got to crack some eggs to make an omelet, meaning that you have to do something that's maybe not so good in order to get a good result. And this one, just like the word omelet itself, comes from the French, where it was a proverb going back to the early 1700s. And its first recorded use in English was in 1796 in an Irish monthly that quoted one of the leaders of a royalist counter-revolt during the French Revolution, a general by the name of François de Charette. And when he was captured and put on trial and accused of causing the death of a lot of people, he responded, yes, omelets aren't made without breaking some eggs. And it's not too shocking, I guess, that he was soon thereafter executed by a firing squad. And this one continued to have grisly associations with bloodshed. An article by the Times of London in 1897 about a grueling march of the British Indian Army to take back the Khyber Pass in Pakistan from local tribes described how many of the support personnel that were brought along to carry stretchers and equipment had been frozen by the cold and terrified by the bullets whistling overhead. And they collapsed and died along the way. And then it went on to callously sum this up. However, omelets can be made without breaking some eggs, and war cannot be waged without losses of this kind occurring. In fact, lots of people on the internet and elsewhere mistakenly attribute this idiom to Lenin or Stalin, which makes sense given that Russia is rather infamous throughout its history for using human wave-style assaults, a barbaric tactic that continues up until today in eastern Ukraine. But even though they might not be on record as using this idiom specifically, it does convey quite well the classic cold-blooded rationalization of self-deluded dictators. Although eggs are great on their own as boiled or in an omelet, they're also used in the kitchen for all kinds of dishes. They can help bind mixers together and are used as the glue for baked goods, meatloaf, casseroles. Or they can be used as an emulsifier for things like mayonnaise or hollandaise sauce. Or as a leavening agent. Just whip some air into them and use them for lemon meringue pie or angel food cake. Or as a tenderizer and moisturizer for baked goods. A thickener for sauces and custards and curds. To coat and seal things like fried chicken. Or as a glaze to color and shine. Brush some eggs on your pies or buns. In short, they're super versatile. And they're not just versatile in the kitchen, they're versatile in the language as well. And they can even be kind of Janus-faced, which, if you'll recall from last season, is where a word can mean both one thing and that thing's opposite, also called a contronym, like to dust, which can mean to remove dust but also add it, to rent, which can mean to charge money for the use of property but also receive it, to sanction, meaning to disapprove but also approve, to cleave, to split, but also to adhere to clip, to attach something, but also cut it off, to buckle, to enjoin, to screen. Well, with egg, we can call someone a good egg, but also a bad egg. And calling someone a good egg is kind of a friendly, old-fashioned way of calling somebody a good guy or a kind person. Calling someone a good egg also carries the connotation of saying that person is decent and dependable, trustworthy, not reliable or corrupt. In other words, the opposite of a bad egg, somebody who is dishonest, reprehensible, unreliable, a good-for-nothing, or if used with less real intent, roguish or rakish. And that's actually how good egg likely arose as an idiom, as a reaction to the older idiom bad egg, which appears to have been first used as an idiom in 1855 in Samuel A. Hammett's novel Captain Priest, where he writes, "In the language of his class, the perfect bird generally turns out to be a bad egg." And this one also connotes somebody who fails to meet expectations, who's disappointing, someone that on the outside might appear okay, but when you crack the shell, it turns out to be rotten inside. And speaking of rotten, you might think that the idiom rotten egg means the same thing as bad egg, and it can be used that way, but it also means somebody who's the last or slowest in a group, and it comes from the childhood taunt, "Last one in is a rotten egg." And as a kid, we used to say this to each other all the time, just to make a race out of doing something or getting somewhere. We'd yell out, "Last one in's a rotten egg." So as to the question of where it came from, the best answer is probably just that, childhood. But there's some logic there, too, as the last egg used up is bound to be the most likely one to turn out to be rotten. At any rate, according to the Dictionary of Catchphrases, American and British, from the 16th century to the present day, the rotten egg children's taunt is originally from the U.S., and it arose in the late 19th century or early 20th. And you might tell a bad egg to go suck an egg, an idiom meaning to go take a hike, buzz off, usually used as a rude way to tell someone to go away or leave you alone, although you sometimes hear it as just a general expression of anger, scorn, disdain. "Hey, nice haircut. Did you use a hedge trimmer? Oh, go suck an egg." And this one's been around for a long time. Bit quaint, but it hasn't been around as long as the even quainter phrase, "teaching your grandma to suck eggs," which I'd never heard before, but is apparently more common over in the UK. And it refers to a person giving advice to another person in a subject with which the person is already familiar. It's thought that the meaning of this one derives from the fact that back in the day, the simplest way for elderly people with bad teeth to get their protein was to poke a pinhole in the shell of a raw egg and suck out the contents. And a grandma was usually, therefore, already a pretty practiced expert on sucking eggs and did not need anyone to show her how to do it. So there's those that think that "go suck an egg" comes from this older phrase involving grandmas, but I think it's more likely that it came about independently, as egg sucking just seems like an insult-worthy activity. Think here of a prior episode where we looked at Teddy Roosevelt and his coinage of weasel words, which referred to how a weasel sucks the good stuff out of an egg, just like weasel words had the meat sucked out of them. And if you were sucking some eggs, you're probably bound to get egg on your face, an idiom I kind of like to use from time to time. And this means to suffer some humiliation or embarrassment for having done something or to have done it ineptly. And this one came about fairly recently in America in the last half of the 1900s. But surprisingly enough, considering its recent origin, it's not too clear where it came from exactly or what it refers to. Some theories out there on the internet are that it evolved out of teenage slang and references a messy manner of eating that might leave food around one's mouth, which I suppose could be an embarrassing social gaffe at a meal, or that it goes back to when subpar actors in popular theater in the 1800s would often be pelted with rotten vegetables and eggs and therefore end up with egg on their faces. Another theory talks about how farm dogs sometimes develop a taste for eggs, and in order to find out which dog is the perpetrator, a farmer will look for the egg on the dog's face, a sure sign of guilt. But my theory is that it might come from egging, which is the act of throwing eggs at people or property, a time-honored Halloween tradition of mild vandalism. But there's a whole history of people throwing eggs at politicians or other high-profile figures as a form of protest. And high-profile people who have been egged include David Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Viktor Yanukovych. I saw a news article about this one just a couple of months ago when somebody threw an egg at King Charles III during one of his early walkabouts as the new king. And the idea behind egging someone is more to embarrass them and draw attention to something than to actually injure them, I think. Kind of like shoving a pie in someone's face. So It makes sense to me that it would be connected to the idiom Aegon one's face, but who knows? Apart from actually egging someone, you can egg someone on, meaning to incite, to provoke, goad, to urge someone to do something, often something mischievous. He wouldn't have done it if his friends hadn't egged him on. And this one actually has a rather surprising etymology. It has nothing to do with eggs, nor is it connected to other phrases that use egg as a verb, like over-egg the pudding. The origin is actually the old Norse word eggja, to incite, which is related to the Old English for edge, and in particular it described the sharp edge of a sword. So there are those that think that egging somebody on means provoking them by poking them with something sharp. Anyhow, the word came into English around the year 1200, and it's about the only context that you hear this verb used anymore. And over-egg the pudding, that's mainly a British one. You don't hear it much here in America, maybe because we're not as enamored with pudding as the Brits. But it's one that has a couple of meanings. First, it can mean that you try so hard to improve something that you spoil it, for example, by making it seem exaggerated or extreme. And second, it can mean to make something seem larger, more important, better, or worse than it really is. And this one originated as a simple literal phrase alluding to the way that baked goods may be spoiled by using too many eggs. Then there's egghead, which is an idiom used as an epithet to refer to intellectuals or people considered out of touch with ordinary people and lacking in common sense or practical experience, the ivory tower type. A famous use of this one is when Richard Nixon used it against the Democratic nominee for president in 1952, Adlai Stevenson. In fact, if you ask people today what they know about Stevenson, if they know anything, I'd bet the first thing they'd say is that he was an egghead. And this one was also used by Clinton advisor Paul Begala in the 2008 presidential campaign to describe Senator Barack Obama's supporters when he said, "Obama can't win with just the eggheads and African Americans." I was back in that testy race with Hillary. And the use of this one really got going in the 1950s in America after Nixon's famous use, although the precise origin isn't clear, but it could have had something to do with the phrase bald as an egg, as your stereotypical intellectual is often pictured as balding with an egg-shaped head, which if you take a look at some of the pictures of Adlai Stevenson, he really did have kind of an egg-shaped head. But the use of this one has continued in U.S. politics up until today. You had Donald Trump making news back in 2016 for dismissing the international regulations that ban torture as just being developed by some eggheads. There's an entertaining story about Stevenson, maybe apocryphal, but it was before the days of the ubiquitous smartphone recording device, so who knows. But it was about how he was campaigning for president in 1952, and he was told by an enthusiastic voter that he had the support of every thinking person in the country. "That's not enough, madam," Stevenson supposedly answered. "We need a majority." Finally, just quickly, let's take a look at a few more egg idioms, although one could spend days pondering the ancient question of which came first, the chicken or the egg, delving into infinite regresses and the like. But if I had to choose, my money would be on the chicken. Although it's true that all chickens are hatched from chicken eggs, it seems to me more likely that the first thing that had evolved into something different enough from what came before so that we'd call it a chicken or a chicken egg, that's got to be the chicken. All eggs look alike. But speaking of money, there are a few egg idioms out there dealing with that, like one's egg money, sometimes also heard as one's egg and butter money, meaning the money you have stashed away for buying little pleasure or home items. It's kind of an old-fashioned one, as it comes from the money that a farm woman earns for selling it butter and eggs, something that's not as common these days, obviously. Then there's don't put all your eggs in one basket, which is often used as a bit of financial advice, counseling one to diversify your investments, not putting all your money in one asset or stock, for example. And this one is said to have been first used in the novel Don Quixote, where it was written, "It is the part of a wise man to keep himself today for tomorrow and not venture all his eggs in one basket." Finally, there's nest egg, meaning the savings that are set aside for future use, typically for one's retirement. The stock market crash has smashed the nest egg for my retirement. And this one has got kind of an interesting origin. A nest egg refers to the age-old practice of placing a real or fake egg into hens' nests to encourage them to lay more eggs. And these decoys, which have been used since at least the 14th century, were also called nest eggs. And there's also kind of a link there with the interest that you earn on invested capital. Put one egg in, get two out kind of thing, just like you put $100 into some retirement investment, hoping you'll be taking $200 or more out. But even with the recent rise in egg prices, I still wouldn't advise just hanging on to them as a retirement investment. Even the best egg will break bad eventually. But that's enough about eggs. Thanks for listening.